The former infrastructure minister had the fairly straightforward task of bringing forward a local government bill which was generally supported by local authorities. Along came Laurie Hooper with an amendment which caused angst and anger among local authorities and was subsequently used as one of the reasons for the minister's sacking. To tell us what the bill actually does and why the amendment caused so much consternation, I'm joined in the studio by the former minister Michelle Haywood and Douglas City councillor Devon Watson. The reason that this has hit the headlines, though, is because of the introduction, round about this time last year, of a clause that, according to local authorities, is controversial. Now, and I should, at this point, point out that I, of course, am still, just for another month or two, clerk to a local authority down in Arbury and Rushen. So, the former minister, perhaps if we start with you, why, and also former Port St Mary commissioner. And
chair of Port St Mary in my time. Yeah.
Well, there we go. Why is this bill important? Let's ignore the controversial bit. What about the rest of the bill?
The bill's got a number of significant things in it that are important for good governance in local authorities. And it goes right the way back to a petition that came through to Tim Ward and a select committee that made recommendations about this. And the key part of it, really, for me, are the bits that deal with having a code of conduct, making sure that the Nolan principles are enshrined in there so that in terms of public service, we know that people are acting, you know, in a selfless way, and that they're actually acting on behalf of their communities and not for their own personal gains.
For those not in the know, the Nolans, it's nothing to do with the Singing Sisters.
No. It was Lord Nolan, wasn't it? Yeah. And he set principles for being in public service about openness and integrity and honesty. And those are absolutely like core, and they're embedded in the Tim Ward members' code of conduct as well, but they're not down at local government level. So those being embedded, members having to declare their interests, and the we talk about pecuniary interests, so the financial interests, not just for themselves, but for those that are close to them as well. So you couldn't, for example, have a member sat on a local authority board who takes part in a discussion and then a vote, which ends up with his own personal company being awarded a contract, because he would be, you can't manage that conflict of interest. And I there are a number of instances, and I'm sure during your time with local authorities you can think of them as well. There were a number that happened when I was on Port St Mary commissioners where that is a real risk, and it's a risk because it means that decisions aren't always taken with the best interests of the ratepayers and the community at heart. People can be swayed by their own personal gain. And so, you know, the kind of the core plank of this legislation was to get those really good governance structures in place for local authorities, and to require every local authority to provide that code of conduct so that the department could check it through and check that it was compliant and give advice to try and improve the standards of governance.
Devon, that all sounds pretty reasonable, doesn't it?
No, my job is to disagree with government. No, I'm kidding. No, I think one of the problems that we do have, particularly in the local context, is the adversarial nature of so many of our public institutions. And we're in an area where when we agree on 99% of a product, the way our political system is structured and the way our political culture works is that we are primed to focus on that 1% and disagree. You've got departments disagreeing with each other when they are objectively performing the same function. You've got local authorities disagreeing with central government, and you've got the public at each other's throats on contentious issues, when in fact there are only 85,000 of us in this country, and we should be able to work together much more easily on contentious issues. And I think that 90% or 99% of this bill, we fully agree with. In fact, the council, or Douglas Council, wanted to see further on certain measures. For example, we're really keen to see the introduction of DBS checks for councillors, making sure that if you're a councillor and you're interacting with a vulnerable people, young people, women, that you are someone who is of sound character, that you've got no criminal convictions behind you. We're really keen to see that conflicts of interest legislation is being brought in. We want to see local authorities be stronger, and a lot of this bill does do that. A lot of this bill overall does make local authorities stronger by clarifying the bylaws process, clarifying how joint boards work, creating clear and distinct boundaries between local authorities and that sort of thing, clarifying some of how local authorities can work together and how boards within local authorities can work together. And these things are really, really good, and we wanted to see a lot of that work. It also does a lot of things like make it easier for councillors and commissioners who don't to sort of attend meetings remotely, get childcare, get things like expenses covered, and make it easier for them to travel. Because very often people want to represent and serve in local government, but they don't have the capacity to unless they are independently wealthy or they are retired. And it's really important that our democracy reflects the people that have this. And we need to find a better way, because obviously the council and most local authorities and central government disagree on some of the bones of Clause 5, but we need to find a way of approaching these agreements or disagreements in ways that are constructive. And that's not really something we have in the political culture of the island at the moment.
We'll come on to Clause 5, but Michelle, I mean, the other aspects of the bill, I mean, there's things that I know of. It's certainly for Arbery and Rushen, this was one that we were particularly keen on. This was allowing for public open space to be leased. Now, at the moment, the law is quite vague on that, which means that on the one hand, you probably can do it, but on the other hand, there's no legal clarity as to whether you can or can't.
Yeah, and it's an utter nonsense, isn't it, that we just haven't given local authorities the ability to manage the public open space that they own, and to enter into those leases that would be good for, I mean, often they're about supporting community ventures and sports clubs and things where the tenants as want to be there, and they're going to invest in putting up goalposts or building a clubhouse or something in that space, and they need some security of tenure in order to know that when they've done their fundraising, which will inevitably be from the community or from charitable trusts or whoever, that they can actually say, yes, we know we can be here for, you know, the next 21 years or whatever. It has to balance out, and we just haven't really given local authorities the ability to deal with that. And so that is one of the factors that's in this bill, one of the clauses that's there.
And Devon, there are, aside from Clause 5, there were some other issues that some local authorities have had some concern over. There was a view, I think, that the bill was introducing processes and procedures that perhaps were a little overly bureaucratic for many of the structures that exist. Is that fair?
Yeah, I mean, there was some concern locally with the way that bylaws are structured. I mean, I've been persuaded to some extent that particularly when it comes down to bylaws, it actually clarifies and makes it easier. I mean, I think one of the core issues that happens is that all local authorities get treated as the same entity, when in fact they're very, very different organizations. Some local authorities are really small. They do the bare minimum. They maybe have only one part-time member of staff. And you've got some local authorities that do quite a lot of work, right? And I think one of the core concerns that comes in is that even having to meet the non-Clause 5 statutory obligations from smaller local authorities would mean that they won't be able to do that with a part-time clerk. And they would have to be in a case where they consolidate, where they have to restructure how they work. They would have to raise rates in order to sort of adhere to certain processes. And not always a bad thing to sort of make sure that sort of data is protected and make sure that certain core functions are adhered to, because the way that local authorities have been for a long time has sometimes been the Wild West. You can say that the vast majority work fine to a large extent, but I think it's one of those where because you create one sort of set of standards that all local authorities have to adhere to, it creates disproportionate hardship for some of the smaller ones. Obviously, we have the capacity to handle those. That'll be fine. We just sort of integrate that into our day-to-day functioning. And I think that's been some of the concerns that people have. I do think that having a bill that clarifies these relationships is long overdue, and it is really necessary.
I think one of the things I'd like to say is actually it's about fairness, isn't it? That no ratepayer around the island, whoever they're paying the rates to, should expect anything less than a minimum standard of service. And what this bill would have set was that minimum level of service. And I know I've had some pushback from some of the local authorities saying, well, you've lifted this from UK legislation. You're requiring us to do things that, you know, big authorities do and big authorities do as routine and we can't possibly do this. But I think my pushback at that is, if you have the power to set a tax or rates, if you have the power to tell somebody that they're going to pay a bill, and remember that your ratepayers don't negotiate with you over what they're going to pay in the way of tax. They have, once they own that property and it's rated for where it is, they will be paying whatever rate you tell them they will be paying, they will owe you. Once you have that power, you then have a responsibility to be open and transparent with what you are doing with that money and how you are doing it. And that means publishing the minutes of your meetings and making them accessible. It means making your financial statements accessible. It means taking every opportunity to explain to people about how you are functioning. And I think that's where, you know, if you're going to carry on having the power to raise rates, you're going to have to take that. Coming with that is the responsibility to be open and transparent about how you do so.
Yeah, but I think it's also around the public perception of rates is one of those core concerns, right? Because what we see is we see things on the front end. We see improved bin collections. We see improved street lighting. We see like improved parks services or more social housing. But what we don't see at the end of the day, I just want to clarify that rates don't pay for social housing. It's paid for rent and by deficiency payments. But what we see is we see the functions of local authority that are very visible. But that necessary legislative infrastructure on the back end, making sure that data is protected, making sure that conflicts of interest are avoided, making sure that people have the ability to have like clear legal procedures, is just as important as having all of the physical infrastructure. But as a ratepayer, right, you don't see that on the front end, and you only notice things when they go badly, when there is a scandal, or when something doesn't go right, or when there's a big sort of tribunal or dispute. But it's really important that we do have that sort of legislative plumbing and frameworks there to make sure that those front-end services can be delivered. And we sort of fully agree on that sort of aspect of this. I mean, I think there isn't loads of daylight between large chunks of the bill and the DIY and government departments in this, because we do think that if you're a ratepayer, you should have an expectation that public representatives adhere to public principles and adhere to the best standards of integrity, but also make sure at the same time that your money that is being spent is being audited, is making sure that it is going toward the right places.
You alluded earlier there in what you were saying, Devon, to smaller authorities. And yes, okay, I did declare an interest at the start. smaller local authority perhaps not having the staff to do some of this. And yet, it's the larger local authorities, the ones that hit the headlines. You know, Onchan obviously was the cause of this bill coming along in the first place. Port St Mary has had a
churn of clerks, I think they call
it. A fairly famous set of issues. So is that because the smaller local authorities, it might have happened in the smaller local authorities, but no one ever got to find out because they weren't reporting, or what is the issue there?
I think that there's a number of issues, right? So one is there's a general sense of coherence among local authorities in terms of acting as independent political actors, as engaging in joint lobbying efforts in terms of working together and sort of sharing services. So I think that this has sort of been an element of building solidarity among local authorities and sort of local democracies where they view, to some extent, interests have aligned. There's also another perspective in which larger local authorities, because they've got more members, they've got more people, and they've got larger impact on the day-to-day lives of people, they end up having a larger voice. They also typically tend to encourage more sort of political entrepreneurship. People who are looking to engage in political processes start off in local authorities and then sort of maybe move their way around, so they're a lot more likely to be a lot more vocal. A lot of smaller local authorities have long-serving members who serve the communities for decades, and no one gets into local authority politics to get rich. As you know, we don't really take a salary, we get some slight expenses, but it's one of those in which a lot of the indignation comes in at this idea of being regulated when you're doing a public service, right? And you're essentially volunteering and you're being tightly regulated on that. And I think that's one of the things that's caused consternation and pushback. But I think when you take a look at larger local authorities, one of the things that's been the source of pushback is perhaps that a relationship between central government and local authorities hasn't been good for many years. And that's something you have to work to change. I mean, for example, you'll have concerns that councillors and commissioners have around the lack of social housing funding and provision, or the lack of infrastructure investment, or the difficulties of boundaries between work between local authorities and central government. And this ends up being a flashpoint. If the relationship was perfect anyway, you probably would have seen a lot less contention, but this has sort of been a lightning rod for broader structural disagreements between local government and central government over time.
So let's then move on to the controversial part of this bill. Clause 5. Now, you were appointed minister, was it November 2024?
November 24, yeah.
Yeah. Shortly after that, we get to January and the bill is finally starting to make some progress again in the House of Keys. You have a newly appointed member, Laurie Hooper, mm-hmm. and Mr. Hooper comes forward with a series of amendments, two of which included actually holding local authority members personally liable and prone to fines and all the rest of it. Those didn't succeed in the House of Keys, but perhaps they set the tone, do you think, Michelle?
Yeah, I mean, it was quite clearly explained by Laurie when we ended up in front of Legislative Council about the sort of the timeline that ran there, that he'd been working on those amendments in the summer before I'd even become minister, and they were drafted up, you know, before I invited him to come into the department. And when he spoke to Legislative Council, he explained that having attended the Northern Authorities Amenity Site Board, where they clearly could not resolve their differences within that board in order to keep the Northern Civic Amenity Site working, and he said to them, well, the only thing that I can do here is legislate. I mean, that's literally our job, isn't it? It's the only thing we can do is legislate, pretty much. And he said to them, I will legislate. And in fact, the members of LegCo shared the minutes of their meeting, who said actually they'd welcome government legislation around this because they couldn't resolve their differences. And we needed something that would allow the department to step in and direct towards a resolution if one couldn't be found by the local politicians, basically arguing it out in their board structures. And I think what it highlighted is that there are some services that local authorities provide that are provided in statute, and we could go through and amend statutes and start adding things on. Or there was the opportunity, because this bill was coming through, Laurie drafted up this amendment to say, well, OK, in the event that we think that there's a need to, that the department could consult, come up with a scheme, come to Tim Ward and say, do you agree that we should direct local authorities to do this? And if I take the example of the Northern Civic Amenity Site, once one local authority had dropped out of the funding mechanism and wasn't going to play ball anymore, and the others couldn't reconcile how to do it, the department has had to step in. The DOI is currently paying £50,000 a year of taxpayers' money. So ratepayers in the north are already paying towards an amenity site, a service that they expected, but isn't a statutory service. Now government are now paying towards that service as well and making up the shortfall. And the contract went to Ramsay, agreed to run that site for us. But when we said, and can you reopen the reuse centre because that's in the contract, they said, no, we'll hand the contract back. So they gave us 6 weeks' notice and said, we'll close the site down. Now, in consultation with the MHKs for the North, we agreed that it would be absolutely disastrous not to have an amenity site at all for the whole north of the island. You know, everyone's concerned about fly tipping and things. But because this is not a statutory service, there's no mechanism to compel anyone to do anything in this situation. Looking forward to next year, Ramsay have said they don't want to run the contract. It's gone out to procurement. It will cost more to run because it is going to hopefully run with the reuse centre reopen. And one of the key things is, you know, understanding where those those things like those services sit within the bigger picture of, you know, that sits within the waste strategy about being able to recycle and reuse things. It's a really important part of managing to deliver on that. So clause five, you know, my kind of base level demonstration of it is we could step in and say to local authorities, you need to provide amenity site and it needs to be to this standard. Now, I've been around and visited all the amenity sites recently. There are problems over in the West. They're well documented and out in public now. There have been problems there for a while. I know that Southern residents are really, really unhappy about the fact that their reuse centre is a table outside and then it goes off to a charity shop. And you don't put the same items in a charity shop as you do into reuse. And the Northern site, currently, I believe the reuse sheds there are full of waste electrical goods that haven't been dealt with properly. So we're starting to see services that residents expect fall apart. And the, you know, I imagine the first use of Clause 5, if it goes through, will be that the DOI sets some sort of level of provision standard and says to local authorities, this is what you need to provide. And if you don't provide it, we will step in and provide it because your residents expect these services, and we do all expect those services. But there are a number of things that local authorities do because it's historical, and, you know, they support libraries and swimming pools and things like that, and there's very little statutory requirement for them to do it. So when you get boards that take a notion that they're just going to walk away from services, that's exactly what they can do. And our constituents then turn to us and say, well, this isn't right, this isn't what I want, you know, the local authority is not providing the service I want. And government has, without this clause, has very little power to intervene.
You know,
on that.
As minister, as a former minister now, and indeed as an MHK, and indeed as a commissioner, you can't please everybody. Some people will have a view about one thing, and others will have a different view on that. So, for example, I mean, you use the reuse areas in the south. The Southern Civic Amenity Site Board think that they've come up with quite an innovative way to deal with this. They have established a charity which basically benefits from the money that's raised from the sale of these reuse items, and that charity then gives to a number of local good causes in the south of the island. That's something that you obviously disagree with, so you would not impose that on any of the other areas, but actually it might be that's a better idea than what you've come up with.
It would be, but what you've done there is you've narrowed what goes into reuse, because it's stuff that can be resold. And if you remember the old reuse centre down there, you know, you'd go in and you'd find a chair that needed renovating, or you'd find a garden rake, or you'd find plumbing fittings or you know, old plant pots. Or those things are not going to appear in the charity shops, and so what you're now doing is more items that should and could be reused are instead just going into the waste stream, and that's kind of, it's morally wrong, it's environmentally wrong, it's not where we should be at. We need to encourage greater reuse and greater amount of recycling and things. But I think, you know, that's the kind of minor example about where do we set those service standards that we expect. And I'm hoping that the waste strategy gets published and local authorities look at it and go, okay. And some of that will mean an upping of standards. You know, it will mean trying to push yourself towards those targets to increase the amount of reuse and to increase the amount of recycling. And how it's actually happened is, it's not prescriptive in the waste strategy at all. It's up to local authorities to work out what fits, because there is a massive difference between rural local authorities and urban local authorities. And I know from my time in Ports and Merry Commissioners, trying to do curbside recycling just diverted stuff away from the DOI bring banks, didn't cut the amount of waste we were sending to the Energy from Waste plant, and created an extra round of salaries that we were paying for collecting materials that people were going to recycle anyway. They just put them on their doorstep rather than carrying them across to the drop banks. And so you diverted waste. And so the solutions to those things will be found locally, which is why it's not prescriptive. But we may well be prescriptive about, you know, the targets for cutting the amount that goes into the Energy from Waste plant, increasing the amount that's in reuse and recycling, because that's the right thing to do.
I think it's one of those as well where, sorry, just to leap in on this issue, is that I think one of the things that I think that we have to talk about, like, mechanisms, right? And because as legislators, the mechanism that you have is legislation, that is the mechanism that we use to sort of solve things. You know, that old joke about the Marines, I guess, is that when everything, when you all you have is a hammer, everything the best way to, like, everything looks like nails, right? But I think it's one of those things when you look at where services do work well, and no comment about some of the other amenity sites, but our amenity site is getting better every year, right? So, for example, without any legislation coming in dictating what we should be doing, is that you now see things like Tetra Pak being recycled. And we aren't doing that because we have to. We're doing that because we want to genuinely care about the environment. We're partnering with Men in Sheds to create different reuse items so that appliances can be repaired and brought back into use. I mean,
you are like the poster child, though, for how to run for a good amenity site that's forward looking, that's trying to reduce its waste streams and is trying to reuse and recycle one of things as much as possible. And clause 5 doesn't have to be used the fact that it exists and that it means that you know the minister can sit there and say, look, if you don't play ball here, you work out how you're going to do it, but if you don't play ball, I do have the power to get Tim Walt to say you need to comply with this. I think it's a stick. Yep. I would hope that there's a negotiated carrot. However, my experience during my time as minister, and certainly from trying to do things up in the north with the amenity site there, is that not all local authorities play ball, and not all of them want to, and they'll do it for their own reasons. They'll do it because they think they're hard done by some funding formula that was set up ages ago. But rather than being, as I say, grown-up politicians about it and managing to negotiate their way through that, you know, we ended up at an impasse where services that local people want are going to go, and the responsibility of local authorities has got to be to carry on providing those services.
There's so much that we can discuss here. We'll come on to the waste strategy, but first, I mean, everyone is sort of being, how would we put it, quite polite at the moment, but ultimately, the smallest local authority is generally deemed to be the one that's responsible for a lot of this turmoil. And, you know, I'll be the first to break cover and name names. This is Bride Parish Commissioners. Surely to goodness, the MHKs for the area could have gone down and spoken to Bride and said, look, you're about to upset an apple cart here. Bride Commissioners benefits massively from commercial rates, particularly from the old tip, the quarries down there. They have a huge amount. I mean, their rate is something like half the rate of their neighbours, the domestic rate, because of all this commercial income that they're getting. To me, it seems like those levers of power weren't pulled. I mean, is that fair?
Some of those levers of power were being pulled at before I became minister, obviously, because we ended up in the position where we'd reached the impasse before I came into post. I know that the MHKs up there had conversations with Bride, and nobody was seemingly managing to move it along. Mr. Hooper himself had been up and met with them as well and had long discussions with them. I don't want to focus just on Bride, because I think there are a number of instances I know where we haven't installed crossings to get children to school safely because the local authority is the street lighting authority and they've refused to pay for two streetlights, and you can't put a crossing in on a dark stretch of road because it would be fundamentally unsafe. And so children don't get a crossing to school because the local authority won't put streetlights in. That is bonkers. That is just so wrong that they have the ability to do that. And I think once you start getting into what do local authorities have control over and whether they should, I'm firmly of the opinion that most local authorities shouldn't be controlling streetlights anyway, because they should be placed according to highways design guidance about where do they light the junction properly, where do they light the footpaths properly. And most local authority members are not highways engineers and aren't capable of doing that. And the MUA goes around for most of the local authorities, you know, replacing broken and decrepit ones, but they were perhaps never placed in the right place in the first place. And so you start ending up with, if you look at the functions of local authorities, that some of them are just, it feels to me, sat in the wrong place. And once you start getting to the...
I just want to push on this little item. And I think the problem is that when we treat... I think there's a problem with some of these legislative mechanisms, because when you look at a place like us, like, we have some of the best street lighting anywhere. And we know that if that was handled by central government, you'd end up in a place where we would be deprioritized, right? You'd end up seeing funding going away from Douglas because we control our own funding. Because the thing is, we've now got a system whereby every streetlight communicates with our depot, and then we know that a streetlight's going to break before it has broken. And these are the systems that we've implemented. And there's no way of ensuring that that gets done. I think one of the broader problems that we're touching on here, and the fundamental issue, is that the incentives faced by commissioners and councillors, right? And what you see is, because we live in a democracy that is governed by Facebook, you end up in a situation where the pressure overwhelmingly is to keep rates low.
And that's a bold statement you've just made there.
Yeah, I mean, we are governed by Facebook. It's just obvious. I mean, the fact that, like, everybody responds to pressure on Facebook and a commenter on Facebook, it does not always represent national democracy, but it's also one of those in which we respond heavily to it, and we respond to the negative comments about a rates increase. And investing in public services is hard. It is really, really difficult. But that's something we're going to do. We're going to be announcing on Friday announced a 2.99% rates increase, which is below the rates of inflation, but that also includes things like free car parking in Shoresbrough and Bottleneck car parks on weekends for a year. We're investing in overhauling and building 8 new parks everywhere. We're upgrading, we're putting another £500,000 into streetlights. We're investing in rebuilding some of the systems around the crematorium, making sure that the only crematorium on the island which is run by a local authority is made to the highest standards. And one of the concerns that we have in Douglas is that legislation that would deal with specific bad behavior in smaller local authorities would sometimes create these bureaucratic mechanisms that prevent us from being able to do the role that we effectively need to do. And a core example of this is a petition process. So petition processes that exist to ensure decent good spending by smaller local authorities end up meaning that contractors can't bid for us because it can take 9 months, sometimes a year, sometimes a year and a half, to get a petition for money that we have that we want to spend approved. And sometimes the mechanisms that exist can be heavy-handed, can be clunky. So we need to find a better way of working and a better way of getting certain things across, because we agree with the message that everyone deserves better public services, but trying to deliver that in a way that does not create bureaucracy that prevents decent actions from taking place is a difficult, tricky task. And I sympathize with Tynwald members who have to navigate this, trying to make sure that Bride simultaneously adheres to its statutory obligations whilst also creating legislation that doesn't hamstring other local authorities is a difficult task.
But that's Michelle. The issue, isn't it? For Bride, it's not a statutory obligation to provide an amenity site. No local authority is under a statutory obligation. Now, we could have gone in and changed the Public Health Act and made it statutory that, as well as dealing with household waste, which is what local authorities are obliged to do, we also say by providing an amenity site or access to amenity site. And you know, we could go around and you could amend all sorts of bits of legislation to bring things into statute. What Clause 5 does is just create the power to do that separately anyway, rather than having to go around and amend lots and lots of different acts. So you do it in specific things. I think, though, coming back to the whole Bride situation, there are disparities between local authorities depending on the level of business rates that they get, the commercial rates that they get, and the level of residential payments that are made. And so there are some local authorities that are very, very rich because they have the hospital within their boundaries, and they have large industrial estates, or they have the airport, or they have quarries that supplement that. And then there are others, and you know, I point to Port St Mary. Port St Mary always gets charged with the fact that its rates are exceptionally high, but actually that's mainly because it's residents that pay the rates. There are very few businesses in there paying rates. It doesn't make a significant difference to the amount of the rate take. And so the rate payers are actually paying for the services directly. They're not being subsidised by a large business take. And
this all sounds to me, hopefully we'll get back to waste, but this all sounds to me like we have a system. It's a very clunky system. We haven't, as far as I can see, we haven't agreed what standards there should be. We haven't agreed what should be delivered by local government, what should be delivered by national government. We've not had the conversation, actually, which says, you know what, maybe we don't need local government in an island of 86,000 people, maybe it could all be run by central government. I mean, all these conversations, presumably they need to be had so that at least if you agree that there should be local government, then you need to agree what local government should do. Surely that's a good starting point.
I'm a big fan of local government. I have been all the way through, although I think when I said that in the LegCo evidence session, there was a... But you know, just the level of understanding. I've been a big champion of local government, but good local government. Good local government that's run on sound principles, where it's open and it's transparent and it's accountable, is what we need. But I think there are some bits that archaically have ended up in local government that it just doesn't seem to make any sense. Why are local governments collecting water and sewage rates on the bills? The MUA bills every household directly for electricity anyway. Why is it not just managed through there? We don't need a third party in the transaction. If I come back to streetlights, Douglas isn't a bit of an exception, but I've had discussions over streetlights along the Prom being particularly poor for those people who've got sight difficulties, that they might look great and they might talk to each other and they might be all beautifully controlled and colour-coded and all sorts of things. However, they don't light up the pavements well enough for people to move around safely at night around those areas. And so, there are some challenges over the decisions that can be made there. But when you get to most of the local authorities, they've got one supplier, the MUA, who comes in and deals with all of those. And then the MUA bills them back for the electricity, for the lights that they've installed, and they bill them for the lights. And I know local authorities have loans to replace those lights.
These are great answers, but why, when you were appointed minister, did you not think, actually, you know what, we need a big conversation, we need to have this conversation. It doesn't need to take a long time, but we need to decide what are the boundaries between central and local government.
But this administration, right at the very start, decided it was not going to tackle local authority reform or rates reform. And the two get inextricably linked, don't they? Because what services you're paying for, what services you get and how those are delivered, it's all part of the same conversation.
But what a tremendous piece of work.
And it was absolutely avoided by this administration.
As minister, what a tremendous piece of work you could have left to the new administration. You could have had the conversation, you could have spoken to all the local authorities, you could have agreed what the standards and the direction needs to be, and that it could have been an election.
And written on my whiteboard in my old ministerial office, which the new minister will have inherited now, is a little list, and it actually has on there highways charter, and it has parking controls, and it has a number of things. And you'll know that Mr. Hooper and I reinstated the housing conference with local authorities to start saying how do we deal with social housing, how do we deal with what are your plans and where are you going. And actually on my list still to deal with, but not anymore obviously, was to go and have those conversations. This bill, as you've said though, is so overdue that actually moving it forward, Laurie drops a clause in there that does what it does. I think some of the claims that we've heard about that particular clause are just outrageously false, and I'm not sure that some of the people who've been making those claims shouldn't just go away and give their heads a bit of a wobble, to be honest, because they have over exaggerated and overplayed it so many times.
They would argue the same about you banging on about, well, I mean, you mentioned in you yes, I've just remembered. I'm trying not to be biased in any
which
way.
Which role
shape
are
or
you
form.
Here? Yeah,
but you certainly, in your departing speech or departing interview, mentioned that clerks were responsible for the local authority kickback against Clause 5.
I said that some clerks had been putting out information that was responsible. And clerks are not a political role, are they?
No.
They're there to advise their board members, and some of the advice from clerks to their board members is just factually incorrect. I think the repeated demonstration of a lack of understanding about how laws are made, how Tim Ward functions, and how this bill has processed through, and at what point you get to make comments, and what point you get to interject on it. So it, just to take as an example, we have an evidence session at Legislative Council. They listen to everyone. Everyone is given a chance to speak and to answer questions, and that's it runs on for a good couple of hours. And at the end, when Legislative Council voted to move on to the next stage, which was for them to sit and examine the clauses, there were gasps of shock around the room, as though people in the room believed that somehow LegCo had suddenly approved something. And all they'd done was decide to move on to the next step in their procedure and looking at the bill. They'd just concluded the evidence session. And I think that's a real shame that people who are involved in local politics, and Devon spoke earlier about people getting involved in local politics because they see it as a stepping stone to national politics. And if you've genuinely got that interest
in how politics works,
then I think it's a real shame that people just miss, I just really genuinely don't try and understand the system.
I mean, Devon? I think maybe need to reframe, because I don't mean that like people necessarily engage in local politics as a way of stepping into national politics. It's a long thing that I've been... local authorities have value in their own right, and they provide critical services in their own right. For example, housing and libraries are largely provided by local authorities, not by national government. If you care about these issues, this is where you go. And many people who've served, the vast majority of people who join Douglas Council or most local authorities, never make an attempt to go up into to national government. But one thing I want to talk about is briefly about the concepts of democracy and how we solve problems, right? Because I agree that if some people don't like the way that lights are on the prom or whatever, then there is a mechanism to deal with that, and that is the local authority elections that come out every 4 years. People sort of
if your site is challenged and that prom, actually the way you deal with it is you don't go down the prom at night, so you've created an environment that is not welcoming to people who have site challenges because of managing to navigate it safely. So it doesn't follow through. What my point was about that is that, you know, there are highways design guidance rules that apply to lighting and lighting installations and things like that, and that local authorities are often unaware of those, and they don't challenge those, and they don't take those through an accessibility assessment for when they make decisions like that. And so you end up with some really weird decisions being made because of it's easier to place the lamppost here than it is there, or it's, you know, it's cheaper because we're going to not have to cable so far, or whatever it is, rather than them being made on the grounds that they should be, which is functionality and safety.
I mean, one thing I'd push back is the luminosity has increased, right? So you end up seeing, because LED lights are brighter, you end up seeing greater luminosity. And yes, some people might dislike the changes in prom, particularly from an aesthetic perspective. But I think that the mechanism whereby we deal with a lot of these problems is changing the incentives around joining or participating within local government, right? So if people want this, and if people are desperate, if there's a huge public outcry and people want something, really, the council to do something completely different regarding the promenade, then they will elect councillors and they'll stand for election on the promise to change the way certain things are done on the promenade. I think having the government come in and sort of set a standard that every streetlight must have a certain amount of luminosity and this bit and this, and then regulate every local authority all over the island to say that every streetlight must be to a specific standard, is a much more clunky mechanism than engaging with the democratic process. And we've seen the council reform and change, and many commissioners reform and change on the basis of this. But the core problem we have is that many members in many smaller local authorities have been elected on the promise of keeping rates low in a fair. And yes, that does mean there's a sacrifice that some people don't have the same level of services. It's not a decision I'd make, but it's often a decision between constituents and local politicians. And this is a system working to a large extent as designed. I think that there probably has to be clearer language around joint boards, like dealing with, for example, a local authority that doesn't pay its obligations toward a joint board. But at the same time, I do think that if voters are desperate, for example, to see a library in the middle of Malou, then they would vote to have a library in the middle of Malou. So I'd be quite keen to see mechanisms whereby we create additional incentives and make it easier for people to engage and be in local authorities. And then you get a better standard of governance.
But then down to the local authorities, isn't it? And part of this bill is about local authorities publishing the minutes and publishing their decisions and allowing people to see the decisions that are being made on their behalf. And yet that's what I'm getting pushback from some of the local authorities about, is not wanting to publish that information.
We are starting to get towards the end of the programme, and there is an issue. Well, there's several issues I'd like to talk about. In fact, we could probably keep going for another hour. Waste. Okay. Devon mentioned there about setting standards. I mean, there already are standards for lighting highways. They are already set, that they're available. Waste. Waste standards are set by the minister. The minister has power to do this. When was the last time a minister actually set standards?
The previous waste strategy has run out. It ran out a couple of years ago.
And I'm not talking about strategy. I'm talking about setting the standards, which you have the legal power to do as a minister.
Who knows? I mean, I inherited a situation where, I think you remember when Mr. Thomas was minister, he informed Tim Wall that he'd got a new waste strategy and he ticked it off the island plan. Actually, it wasn't a waste strategy. It was just a report on the previous one. There have been significant changes around environmental standards, which are not necessarily set, not originated here on the island. You know, they'll be set in Europe and in Westminster, and we end up having to comply. So we can talk about waste electrical goods in that context, because we need to export. We have to comply with the rules about where we're going to. So a lot of those standards are actually set external to the department.
I suppose the reason I'm putting that forward, because I know that certainly hasn't happened since I left office. It didn't happen when I was in office. It was something I was hoping that we would be able to get to, but we never did. You know, there is the ability for the department to set standards relating to waste. It is also fair to say that to a certain extent, it's the department's responsibility to set those standards. I mean, the law is pretty clear on that. Things have changed dramatically over the course of the last 20 years in relation to how we see waste. And local authorities kind of depend on the department setting all this. Now, you brought to Tynwald a waste strategy. Why did you not think to actually engage with the waste collection authorities, which are the local authorities, or indeed even let them know that was going to Tynwald?
So there was a consultation about the principles of the waste strategy, and the strategy that's come forward is absolutely in line with the responses that were given then. So it has been consulted with the local authorities. But I think the key step change...
That was a general consultation.
The step change, though, actually doesn't affect local authorities, because the step change in the waste strategy now is to say the last waste strategy only dealt with household waste. And you're right, it's local authorities targeted. The new waste strategy that's come forward deals with all waste streams. And so suddenly local authorities become 15% of that equation. The big bulk of waste actually comes from construction industry. And we'd engage with the construction industry about how they do that. So one of the key proposals in that, if you noticed, was a new version of a landfill tax, basically, so that because we only have a very tiny amount of landfill available to us, and it's really precious, that we only use it for the materials that absolutely need to go in there. And so if a construction company turns up with mixed waste that's got timber and plasterboard and everything mixed into it, that there would be a tax on that, because we would be wasting precious landfill space by putting timber in there that didn't need to be there. So it forces the construction industry to sort their waste and to send it via the appropriate streams. And then the other part of the waste that's in there is business and government waste. Now, mostly businesses have contractors that deal with their waste streams, but the new waste strategy, and it is a step change away from the old one, was to say, here's all of our waste, how do we deal with every single part of this? Because it's no point just talking about household waste with local authorities. They're the authority for collecting household waste from households.
And presumably recycling.
Well. And actually, I mean, you'll know.
Because that's a vague thing. I mean, is recyclate, bottles, tins, are they waste? They definitely are local authorities' responsibility.
They're the things that we definitely don't want in the energy from waste plant. You don't want the glass, and you don't want the metals, and you don't want the batteries and the electrical goods. Anything else can logically go in there. The question is, what is it well to do? And several times during the document, it references waste audits and the idea that you sit down and you do the entire life cycle of, okay, so I have I take Douglas as an example. They're running curbside collections. They're running very, very well. It works for them, and that's fine. But it wouldn't work if I sent that up to, if I said go and do the same thing up in Patrick or Michael, because the distance between the houses is too far. You've got long driveways to go down. You'd spend so much time going around and burn so much fossil fuels doing it for the waste that you collect, that the equation starts to shift. And so what the, you know, the concept of running a waste audit is that we challenge local authorities to sit there and think, well, what does the waste really mean? The things that we don't want in the energy from waste pump, because they contribute to the amount of bottom ash that we have to deal with, and that's a problem in itself.
Devin, because we were almost out of time now, but do you want to respond to any of that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's one of those that we need to start changing the way that we think of waste. And I think that there's, waste has, I mean, even the term waste, it's just one of those where when you produce paper, plastic, tin, you end up in a sort of, or aluminium, these are things that can be recycled into brand new products, right? And I know that this is obvious, but currently we spend maybe £100 per ton burning that at the energy from waste plant, and instead we've managed to go to ratepayers and say, hey, listen, one of the reasons why we can finance really vast improvements to public services but at the same time also have a below inflation rates increase is because we're spending more money, we're spending less money burning waste that we can otherwise recycle. And that just makes sense financially, but it also makes sense environmentally. We do detailed carbon and waste audits, and we find out that at the end of the day, that's also better for the environment. We've provided these numbers both to ourselves and to the DOI.
And the other bit that needs to come into that, though, is that if we burn it at the energy from waste plant, then I don't import gas to burn it to generate electricity. And so there needs to be, although I get it from your local authority perspective, that needs to be in the national context of what am I displacing.
Well, very, very sadly, we are now out of time. I can see that we could easily do a part two of this at some point. That was former Infrastructure Minister Michelle Haywood and Douglas City Councillor Devin Watson. So what do you think? All the storm in the teacup? Was the former minister not listening, or were the local authorities not hearing? Perhaps both. Any clearer about who is actually responsible for what? Let me know your thoughts on the programme by contacting Phil Gorn at manxradio.com, and get in touch if you have any ideas for future shows. Don't forget, this programme is available as a podcast. I'm Phil Gorn. Go to Myosungeistocrum. Thanks for listening.